All right, so Song of Solomon, chapters 6, 7, and 8. Tonight we'll go ahead and finish up this book and just entitle this message Closing Song, because we're closing this song. And so, you know, it's not too hard to see that this book is mostly focused on the physical relationship in marriage. That's been the focus. And there's a lot of good marriage wisdom throughout the Bible, but this is the book, obviously, that focuses the most on the physical side of it. And so I think it's just a good book to come back to and to remind ourselves of in the busyness of life. And also to kind of have in the back of our mind, well, you know, Solomon and his wife had it going well here, but again, things went off somewhere. And things did not end well. And so kind of refreshing ourselves and refreshing our marriages to make sure that we don't go down that same road that he went on. So let's go ahead and get into it. Song of Solomon chapter 6, starting in verse 1. It says, "Where has your beloved gone, O fairest among women? Where has your beloved turned aside that we may seek him with you?" So we're reminded that last week we looked at chapter 5 and there was this dream sequence. And there was some trouble, and Solomon came for a romantic rendezvous late at night in the dream, and she wasn't interested, and then he went away, and she went looking for him, and she couldn't find him. And then these daughters of Jerusalem, this chorus, showed up, and they began asking her, perhaps mockingly, you know, "Where is your beloved?" And then she began to, instead of being bitter about this whole situation, because the commentators believe that there was some situation that happened in their marriage that was kind of manifested itself in the dream, which can often happen. And she begins to recount all the good things about him. And that's what she's done in verses 10 through 16 of chapter 5, is recounting all this good stuff about her husband. And so now as we pick up in chapter 6, we're kind of moving on along with this same theme. And this chorus of voices basically ask her, "Hey, where is he that we may seek him with you?" Now, there's disagreement. Are they being sarcastic? You know, are they still saying, "Yeah, this great guy, where is he?" Or is the chorus saying, "Hey, you know, this guy sounds like something wonderful. Let me go ahead and look for him with you." Well, it really doesn't matter. It doesn't matter whether these voices are sarcastic or these voices are genuine, because what matters is that she wants to find him. So I think the thing to take from chapters 5 and 6 as we move on is to realize when there's a difficulty, a disagreement, and if you've been married more than a day, then there's been a difficulty, there's been a disagreement, is seeking to resolve that, is seeking to resolve issues. And that's what she's doing through this. And it may be a dream sequence, but it's a good lesson for us, is to seek to resolve issues. Don't let matters fester. Don't let that little thing, "Well, he didn't take out the trash like I told him yesterday. And you know what? I'm just going to take it out the trash. I'm not going to ask him again, but I'm going to be mad about it." You know, or this kind of, or whatever it can be. And these issues fester, and it may seem like dumb little things to us, but it's kind of like if you were out running, and you're running, and just that little rock gets in your shoe. And it may seem like no big deal. I'm just going to leave it there. But as you run with that rock in your shoe, the longer that you leave it there, the more not only of an irritant it becomes, but it can actually cause a wound in your foot. And so it is in a marriage, is seeking to resolve things quickly and to make sure that those things are put to rest and you can move on. That's what she's seeking to do. Verse 2, she says, "My beloved has gone to his garden, to the bed of spices, to feed his flock in the gardens and to gather lilies." Now, again, is this a literal garden she's talking about? Is this figurative? A literal garden would mean that she thinks to herself, "Okay, well, I know where to find him. He's going to be out working in such and such area." And some commentators think where it says there in verse 2 that he's gone to gather lilies, that maybe he's getting flowers together to bring me a bouquet. It could be. Flowers are always a good thing, unless you get them like really on a discount and they're all kind of dying and stuff. You know, you want to go ahead and spend the bucks on that. But also it could be figurative, speaking of physical relationship, I'm not sure there. But then I love what she says in verse 3. I am my beloved's, and my beloved is mine. He feeds his flock among the lilies. That's such a good thing. I am my beloved's, and my beloved is mine. And marriage is to be an exclusive relationship. It's to be that exclusive relationship. It's to be that special little club with only two members. There's this desire in human beings to have little clubs. You know, little boys do this, you know, the He-Man Woman Haters Club. You know, that they have when they're little. They have to have their little club, and they got their little tree house or their little tent or whatever it might be, and it's kind of just us. And secret handshakes and all this kind of stuff. And that's really how it's to be in a marriage. That there is to be that exclusive relationship. But what happens is unforgiveness can destroy this club. Unforgiveness can cause this club to separate. Now, it's interesting too in reading, and I knew this already, but I was reminded of it. There are two relationships that it says in the Bible that jealousy is a good thing. Number one is God is jealous for His people. God is jealous for believers. It says in the Scripture that He is a jealous God. And God's not embarrassed about that. Well, I'm going to write this, but man, I'm embarrassed that I'm jealous. No, there's a godly jealousy. God is jealous for His people. But another place we should be jealous is for our spouse. It's okay to want your spouse to yourself. It's okay that you're not going to share your spouse with anybody else. That is a godly jealousy. And so, this is what she's saying. Hey, I am my beloved's, and my beloved is mine. Nobody else. You know, you daughters of Jerusalem, don't get any ideas. But thinking about that idea, that topic of forgiveness, because again, forgiveness is something that is so needed in marriage, because when you put two sinners together, you're going to have problems. I read this quote. It says, "The ability of a couple to succeed in their marriage is equal to the ability of that couple to forgive and accept forgiveness. When this willingness on the part of both becomes a habit, then the bubble of romance that began their relationship will become a diamond that will last forever." I thought that was very poetic. I didn't want to tell you the guy's name because his name is Glickman. It kind of takes a little edge off it. Glickman said this, you know. You wish you would have a more poetic name than that, but God bless him. He knew what he's talking about. But I love this. If in a couple, we choose to forgive and be forgiven. It goes back and forth, and just, you know, we're willing to forgive each other. Then I love how he uses the imagery, that bubble of romance will become a diamond. You know, there's that bubble of romance when you don't really know each other, you know, and you don't know each other, and so everything seems all dreamy and sweet, and then you get to know each other, and all of a sudden you're not quite as wonderful, you know, you've got faults. And so then, but what needs to happen is because you forgive each other their faults, then there's no longer a bubble that's easily burst, but it's a diamond. Something that's hard. It's a relationship that lasts. And so it's a beautiful thing. Now, Solomon speaks to his wife here, starting in verse 4. And it's my opinion that this is no longer a dream sequence, but this is reality. So perhaps she's awoken and whatever they've had their tiff is in the past, and now they're talking to each other. Verse 4. "Oh, my love, you are as beautiful as Tirzah." So as I said earlier, you know, when we first started this study, that this Tirzah is where we kind of taken our name for Solomon's wife. Tirzah was actually the chief city of northern Israel, and it was set on a hill. It was a city of natural and rustic beauty with inviting gardens and groves. So it's a beautiful place. It's a beautiful place. You know, I don't want to insult any towns. But, you know, we can think of towns in our mind that we think, wow, if I called anybody, you know, if I called my wife that town, I'd get slapped. You know, that town is not beautiful, not majestic, you know. So we think in our minds of, you know, tell our wives, you know, you're as beautiful as Paris in the spring. Or, you know, something like that, except without the wimpiness. Something of that sort, and that's kind of what he's going for here. He also says, "You're as lovely as Jerusalem." Jerusalem was the capital of southern Israel. It was also on a hill. It was a place of beauty and majesty. And obviously Jerusalem has been, you know, the center of the nation of Israel. I mean, that's the place. And so he's really telling her how wonderful she is. And then he says to her, "You're awesome as an army with banners." So apparently he was a surfer. "You're awesome, babe." You know, he's awesome as an army with banners. Now, you think about that. What in the world is he talking about? The only way I could think about it as I was kind of contemplating this is if you ever watch this movie, you know, war movies back in the day, and all the soldiers would come out, and they have all their banners, you know, their insignia, and they're there all lined up. I mean, that's an awesome thing. When you see those big battle sequences in movies, it kind of, wow, takes your breath away. And so I think that's what he's saying. You're as breathtaking as this army lined up and ready for battle. It's an amazing thing. So Tirzah is breathtaking and awe-inspiring to Solomon. Verse 5, he says, "Turn your eyes away from me, for they have overcome me." Solomon is overwhelmed, excited, overpowered, unsettled by her eyes. And so, again, remembering that they've had some type of conflict that manifested itself in that dream. So all is forgiven. And Solomon, by way of expressing his love and complimenting his wife here, he's not bringing all those things up. He's just getting right into how much he adores her and loves her. And I love that scripture that says it's a man's glory to overlook a trespass. And I think that's important because sometimes in marriage, maybe our spouse is going to annoy us or do something to us and not even realize it, and we're going to do something to our spouse and not even realize. If both can just forgive without saying it. And now to overlook a trespass is not to say, "I forgave you because you were an idiot doing this. I just want to let you know that I overlooked that trespass." That's not really overlooking the trespass. And so we need to make sure that when we overlook a trespass, we just let it go. And that seems to be what's happening here. Now, the fact that he brings up the eyes in verse 5, it makes us think, you know, how do we look at our spouse? Think about how powerful eyes are. Eyes are incredibly powerful things. Eyes can communicate so much. Eyes can communicate anger or love, acceptance or bitterness, indifference, forgiveness, desire. The list goes on and on, just with the eyes. And so we need to really think about, what am I communicating to my spouse with my eyes? Obviously, Tirzah was communicating desire with her eyes towards Solomon, and Solomon was getting a little, you know, flustered about it. He continues on now. What he's going to do here is he's going to use some compliments that we've already seen him use before. So I'm not going to spend a whole lot of time going into it. But he says, you know, "For your hair is like a flock of goats going down from Gilead." And we thought, flock of goats, wow, never used that one, you know. But we talked about how, you know, these goats with the black hair and coming down the mountain, how it'd be just shimmering. And so apparently she had the gift of hair. You know, she's got this lustrous mane, even in the days before Pantene and all that. And she's got it going on, and so he's excited about that. Verse 6, he says, "Your teeth are like a flock of sheep, which have come up from the washing. Everyone bears twins, and none is barren among you." So you got a nice set of teeth. None of them are missing. And looks like you brush regularly because everything is nice and white. Verse 7, he says, "Like a piece of pomegranate are your temples behind your veil." This is most likely her cheeks, as we talked about, and that she would have a rosy color to her cheeks. And, you know, we might say, well, these are the same compliments that he's given before. But, you know, I really don't think that a wife tires of genuine compliments. She might tire of compliments if they're not genuine. You know, if you're just saying something flippantly and it's not really, you don't really mean it. "Hey, honey, you look good today." "Well, what am I wearing?" "Well, I didn't really look, but, you know, you just always look good." You know, that's not genuine compliment. But, you know, maybe there's going to be a compliment that you use quite a bit because it's always true. Then I don't think that a wife would complain about that too much. Verse 8, "There are 60 queens and 80 concubines and virgins without number. My dove, my perfect one, is the only one of her mother, the favorite of the one who bore her. The daughter saw her and called her blessed, the queens and the concubines, and they praised her." Now, this seems to be a hypothetical to me. Some people say with these 60 queens and 80 concubines, you know, Solomon had already started up his harem and all this kind of stuff. I don't see that at all, because nothing in this book gives us that idea. I believe very strongly that this book is about Solomon and his first wife before things went completely off kilter. And so what he's saying here is, you know, I think it's a hypothetical. You know, there's these 60 queens and these other 80 concubines, and there's all these virgin girls without number, but compared to all of them, you're the only one. You are the only one. So he praises her as the only one. He says, you know, that you're the only one of your mother. You're the one who's blessed. And he goes on and on about her. And the application for us, you know, is to only have eyes for our spouse. To not be comparing our spouse to anyone else. Or, you know, that our spouse is the only one. And that's how it has to be. Now, how is that possible? Well, it's possible if you keep the home fires burning. When your energy and your time and your focus is spent on your spouse, and you're building that relationship, and you're pouring into that relationship, well then, that's going to be your focus. It was interesting listening to a John Corson teaching a couple years back, and he was just talking about the danger of men, you know, forming relationships with women who aren't their wife. And basically what he said is what can happen in a situation is that a Christian man can befriend a Christian woman, and what happens is, you know, they start talking and they start, you know, basically sharing stuff, just, and it may seem innocent at first, but he used this verse. He used Matthew 6:21, where Jesus says, "For where your treasure is, there your heart will be also." It was interesting application because he said, as a man begins to talk to a woman who's not his wife and begins to share his feelings, it's kind of like giving her his treasure. You know, it's giving who he is. And then what happens? His heart goes after it. So then I think to apply this to marriage, then a husband is to pour his treasure into his wife. And that's where his heart's going to be. And the same thing for the wife. As the wife pours her treasure, who she is, into her husband, then what's going to happen is that club, that exclusive club between the two of them, will be close. And I love that. I love the fact that Brandy and I have all these code words and things. Not that we've sat down one night and say, okay, what's our code word for this going to be? What do you think? And when I give you this look, that means this in this situation. If we're in public, okay, that's what, okay. No, it's not like that. You just pour your treasure into each other. You spend time with each other. You become best friends. And I love it because we'll talk oftentimes, and then our kids, especially Phoebe, being the oldest, what are you talking about? Too bad. You don't know. It's between me and your mom. And so that's just how it is, and it should be like that. And that's what's going on here with Solomon and Tirzah at this point. Verse 10, "Who is she who looks forth as the morning, fair as the moon, clean as the sun, awesome as an army with banners?" It kind of seems like a little Romeo and Juliet moment there. But he's talking about his tears here, and that she looks forth as the morning. You think about the morning. Sometimes if I drive into school on the early days, I have to be there, then the sun is rising. And, you know, for all West Texas's faults, geographically, got some beautiful sunrises and sunsets. And you can see them because everything's flat. And so when the sun is coming up and it's that orange or pink, I mean, that is pretty awesome stuff. That's really good. And so that's what he's saying about her. And then she's as fair as the moon. When you see the full moon and it's just bright, shining, that's his Tirzah. As clear as the sun. Now, I don't suggest looking directly into the sun. That doesn't seem like a good idea. But she's as clear as the sun, and again, with the awesome as an army with banners. Now, Tirzah is going to speak and respond in verse 11. "I went down to the garden of nuts to see the verdure of the valley, to see whether the vine had budded and the pomegranates had bloomed." All right, so apparently she's doing some gardening or something. You know, we look at that and that seems to be veiled language for physical intimacy there. And I'll let you do the math on that one. Verse 12, "Before I was even aware, my soul had made me as the chariots of my noble people." Really? I don't even know what's going on there. And you look up, what does this mean? The people have a lot of different ideas. What I would take from verse 12 is that she was just carried away. That with the intimacy that she shared with Solomon, she was just carried away as if going on a chariot. It was just a wonderful time between husband and wife. Now moving on, verse 13, "Return, return, O Shulamite, return, return, that we may look upon you." Now, who is this talking here? It says here, if you have the New King James, "the beloved and his friends." I would disagree with this. Here's where we get into a little disagreement on how to interpret what's going on next. Some see this as a public thing, and some see this as a private. From when I kind of get the context of this whole book, I view this next part as a private affair, not a public thing. I believe that this is Solomon talking to her. Now, O Shulamite, it really can be translated Mrs. Solomon. And so it seems to me that Solomon is calling to her that he may look upon you. When it says we there, he may be using the royal we, as people do. And it says, and then she responds, what would you see in the Shulamite, as it were, the dance of the two camps? Okay, so what is he talking about? There seems to be kind of a flirtatious language here, and I'll just come out with it. There's the idea here that she's kind of doing a dance for Solomon, perhaps in the buff. Oh my goodness. But that seems to be the interpretation of what's happening here. I'm starting in chapter 7, verse 1. How beautiful are your feet in sandals, O prince's daughter. So it starts with the sandals, and obviously, hey, she's good looking, got some good looking feet, could perhaps be a foot model there. But she's going to have some expensive sandals being a queen. And so he's complimenting her, and he's moving his way up. He says, the curves of your thighs are like jewels, the work of the hands of a skillful workman. So he's complimenting her legs. He's basically saying that her legs are a work of art, that she's beautiful and shapely. And he continues on in verse 2, your navel is a rounded goblet. It lacks no blended beverage. Your waist is a heap of wheat and set about with lilies. And so there's different interpretations on exactly what he's speaking of there. And I'll leave that for your further study as well. Verse 3, your two breasts are like two fawns, twins of a gazelle. He said that before. Verse 4, your neck is like an ivory tower. Your eyes like the pools in Heshbon by the gate of Bath Rabim. So he's complimenting her all the way up. And then let me go back to what he says in verse 4. Your neck is like an ivory tower. Kind of interesting to think about. What does this mean? Well, the neck speaks of nobility. It speaks of character. Remember, we've talked about a stiff-necked person or a person who's humble. You know, they bow down. And it could also mean the smoothness of her neck. And so the thing is about Solomon, though, notice, he's not just focused on one thing or another. That he's complimenting her, all of her. He's not just interested in only one thing, but he's making her feel like he cares for all of her. And not just this thing or that thing. And so it's a beautiful thing that he does here. And I like what he says about her eyes. Your eyes are like the pools in Heshbon by the gate of Bath Rabim. By comparing her eyes to these pools of water, speaks of the calm in her eyes, the tranquility of her eyes, the depth of her eyes, that she's just has this influence upon him. Now, here's where some of the ladies don't like what he says. Your nose is like the Tower of Lebanon, which looks toward Damascus. Interesting. What is he talking about here? I really don't know. Exactly. There's all kinds of things and just ideas about it, but none of them seem to be really, very helpful. So apparently it's an okay thing because we don't read that she slaps him or anything. Verse 5. Your head crowns you like Mount Carmel. Mount Carmel is very famous throughout the scriptures, a majestic place. That's where Elijah had his showdown with the prophets of Baal. And so basically that her head is this beautiful, kind of this crown upon her body, this beautiful that just fits with the rest of her. It says your hair, the hair of your head is like purple. And a king is held captive by your tresses. So apparently she was into dyeing her hair. You know, she kind of had a punk thing going. No, I'm not sure about that. It could be that the color of black of her hair, that it had a kind of a tinge of purple to it. Or it could be speaking of royalty. Purple is the color of royalty. And that a king is held captive by your tresses. So she really had a nice looking head of hair. Verse 6, how fair and how pleasant are you, O love, with your delights? this stature of yours is like a palm tree, and your breasts like its clusters. I said, I will go up into the palm tree, I will take hold of its branches. Let now your breasts be like clusters of the vine, the fragrance of your breath like apples, and the roof of your mouth like the best wine. So that's pretty straightforward. You know, there's not a whole lot of dancing around that, to what he's talking about there. So he's obviously very enthralled with her. And he says, you know, your fragrance of your breath like apples, so you smell good. It's pretty good in the days before gum and mouthwash and stuff. And obviously he desires to kiss her, and her kisses with her are like wine, the best wine. Now, she responds in the rest of verse 9, and she says, you know, the wine goes down smoothly for my beloved, moving gently on the lips of sleepers. I am my beloved's, and his desire is toward me. So he's overcome with desire for her, and the realization that in a marriage, that's okay. It's more than okay. And it's interesting, you know, reading these different books about Song of Solomon, and I never really kind of put it in these terms, but it's absolutely true. The way that Satan works, and we know that Satan, from what Jesus said, that he's the father of lies. And the way he has twisted things, and he always perverts things, is he has made it that the physical relationship with marriage, he's bad-mouthed it so much that it's kind of, in the world's view, that it's a ho-hum thing. But the physical relationship outside of marriage, that's where it's at. That's the wonderful thing. And so it's just completely reversed everything. Just completely reversed it, and that's exactly what he does. He promises you the moon, and he delivers you a bag of garbage. That's how he works. And so, this book is telling us that within a marriage relationship, things can be awesome. It can be a wonderful physical relationship within marriage. But ultimately, I think it starts with the heart condition. And so, I believe that rest of verse 9 going into verse 10 speaks after their physical intimacy, and this, when she says, hey, I am my beloved's and his desire is toward me, there's just that closeness. There's that closeness that comes through the physical relationship. And I just want to turn to one place. I know I haven't been having us turn very much here in Song of Solomon, but I want to turn to 1 Corinthians chapter 7. And it's interesting kind of how all these things tie together. I teach a New Testament class to ninth graders, and the way we do it is we read quite a few chapters. We're up to 1 Corinthians right now. We started in Matthew at the beginning of the semester, and then I have them do observation questions, and then when they come in, they ask me all their questions. And I knew it was going to be interesting when we got to this section of Corinthians, because it's all about what Paul has to say about marriage and about divorce and about physical relationship. And talking about all this stuff with ninth graders is delicate, to say the least. But this idea and this realization that the physical relationship within marriage fosters closeness and it creates a bond, Paul brings this out in 1 Corinthians chapter 7, starting in verse 3. He says in verse 3, let the husband render to his wife the affection due her, and likewise also the wife to her husband. Render, you know, we kind of think about that. Okay, honey, here let me give you a hug. I got to render you some affection, you know. But the idea is the affection due her, and likewise the wife to husband. In other words, there's to be a closeness. There's to be a physical closeness. There's to be an emotional closeness. There's to be this a mutual loving each other, basically, in marriage. And that's not only just treating each other with respect, but also the physical act of marriage, the physical relationship. He says in verse 4, to make it clear, the wife does not have authority over her own body, but the husband does. And likewise, the husband does not have authority over his own body, but the wife does. That in physical intimacy, there's to be this sharing, there's to be a mutual submission between the two. And here he says in verse 5, do not deprive one another, except with consent for a time, that you may give yourselves to fasting and prayer, and come together again so that Satan does not tempt you because of your lack of self-control. And obviously what he's speaking of depriving each other is of the sexual relationship. He said, if you're going to stop that for a while because you're going to do prayer and fasting, hey, that's your choice. But it can't be like just for an indefinite period of time. Because what happens is Satan is going to come in. And so there has to be that part of a physical relationship because what's going to happen is Satan's going to come in. And it could be through all different ways and all different areas. But it's kind of like those old movies where there was these two partners and they're fighting, and I like those kind of old movies they're really dumb ones, but they're going to find a mummy or they're going to do this thing. But there's these two guys and they ended up fighting back to back. You know, there's all the ones around them and they're back to back and they're fighting off everybody. What happens in a marriage is when a marriage is strong and the husband and wife are giving affection to each other, then they're kind of like fighting back to back. They're there together, and it's kind of them against the world. But what happens is if that relationship in marriage is just off kilter, and it's just kind of like two ships passing in the night, then what happens is they're separated, and they're easy pickings for the enemy. And so we need to remember that. All right, back to Song of Solomon, chapter 7. Finish off chapter 7, verses 11 through 13. It says, "Come, my beloved, let us go forth to the field. Let us lodge in the villages. Let us get up early to the vineyards and see if the vine has budded, whether the grape blossoms are open and the pomegranates are in bloom. And there I will give you my love. The mandrakes give off a fragrance. At our gates are pleasant fruits, all matter new and old, which I have laid up for you, my beloved." So basically, again, we see this, the language is speaking of a romantic getaway. She's basically saying, hey, let's get out of here. Let's get out of town. Let's go spend some time together. Let's go have a romantic rendezvous somewhere else. And so the application for us would be that you need to take some time to get away with your spouse. You need to take some time to just to have a weekend getaway, to get away from the kids and to get away from everything and to work on that marriage. And that's really what she's desiring to do. So pray about that, about planning a getaway with your spouse. All right, Song of Solomon, chapter 8, verse 1. "Oh, that you were like my brother who nursed at my mother's breast. If I should find you outside, I would kiss you. I would not be despised. I would lead you and bring you into the house of my mother, she who used to instruct me. I would cause you to drink of the spiced wine of the juice of my pomegranate." What in the world? Okay, we have to kind of take ourselves back in time to when she was. Again, context, context, context. Why did she wish that he was like her brother? Well, in that culture, it was actually okay to kiss your brother on the cheek. It was okay to hold hands with your brother or to have that physical affection. But it was actually taboo between a husband and wife to show that affection in public. That's just how the culture was. And so she's basically saying, that desire, I wish I could show that affection to you in public, but that's not how things are done here. So again, the application for us, that it's okay to hold hands with your spouse. It's okay to show physical affection in front of in front of people. It's okay for your kids to know that you love your spouse. I think that's a good and healthy thing. And then she also talks about going into the house of her mother. That seems to speak of acceptance, that he's a part of the family and that he's accepted by the family. And then more veiled language of the physical intimacy there. Continuing on, verse 3, it says, I don't agree well to the daughters of Jerusalem. I don't know all about that, who this is speaking to, because that is just, it's written in by the translators, I'm not sure. But verse 3 says, "His left hand is under my head, and his right hand embraces me." So he's obviously having the physical relationship with her. And he says, "I charge you, O daughters of Jerusalem, do not stir up nor awaken love until it pleases." So don't get into that physical relationship before the time. Now, we see verse 5. "Who is this coming up from the wilderness, leaning upon her beloved?" This is the closeness because of physical intimacy. And so this seems to be them coming back from their getaway. And there's a closeness there. And there's this closeness between the two, and so she's leaning upon Solomon. And it says, I awakened you under the apple tree where your mother brought you forth. There she who bore you brought you forth. So I don't know. There's, again, some disagreement on exactly what that means. Perhaps she was born under an apple tree. I don't know. Yeah, I really can't tell there. Verse 6, we have Tirzah speaking to Solomon. She says, set me as a seal upon your heart, as a seal upon your arm. So you have some different I words that I ripped off from that Intimacy Ignited book for different things that are here. But we see in verse 6, this seal, we realize that love between a husband and wife is intimate. This seal upon, set me as a seal upon your heart, as a seal upon your arm. She wants to be stamped on Solomon's heart. She wants to be stamped on Solomon's arm. You know that old saying, and I never understood it growing up, you know, I know this like the back of my hand. You know, I never really studied the back of my hand that much, you know. But that's the saying, how it's said. So she's basically saying, every time you look at the back of your hand, I want you to see me. Every time you think of something, I want you to think of me. I want to be on your heart. And so there's that intimate of love. And then it continues on, or she continues, for love is as strong as death. Jealousy as cruel as the grave. Its flames are flames of fire, a most vehement flame. So love is intense. Love is intense as death. It's jealousy within a marriage can be as cruel as the grave or Sheol. It's a fiery flame. Now, just kind of as we're wrapping up, I had been thinking about this, and kind of whenever I teach through a book, I feel like I kind of get to know the people a little bit. And, you know, Solomon and Tirzah, or whatever her real name was, they're real people. And I don't know if this is kind of twisted in my own heart, but I'll just confess it. I kind of almost hope that something had happened to her and that she died before Solomon went off the deep end. You know, and I don't say that in kind of a just, you know, well, that's a perverse thing to say. But I just think about, man, the relationship they had and then just how he went so crazy. It just seems so heartbreaking to me. So I guess maybe we'll find out one day what happened, but it just seems like a tremendous bummer. Verse 7, she says, many waters cannot quench love, nor can the floods drown it. And so speaking about love being indestructible, that true love there, I never understood it when I used to watch football and they'd said, well, there's no love lost between these two teams. You know, and I realize later on, it means they've always hated each other. But that this true love, that it remains and that it's indestructible. If a man would give for love all the wealth of his house, it would be utterly despised. She's basically saying here, love is invaluable. Or as the Beatles, Can't Buy Me Love. This is what she's saying here. That if you would try to sell, you know, if you had all your wealth and you try to buy love for it, it's just not going to work. Love is invaluable. Now we have what seems to be a flashback in verse 8, back to the time when Tirzah was a young child, and it's her brother speaking. It says, we have a little sister, and she has no breasts. Well, that's not a nice thing to say. What shall we do for our sister in the day when she is spoken of? Spoken for. So this is really, it's actually a neat picture. It's older brothers looking out for their little sister. And basically saying, she's young right now. She's not of marrying age, and so we have to look out for it. They kind of are, they seem a little mean in how they describe her as not being of marrying age. But, I didn't write it, I just report it. Verse 9 says, if she is a wall, we will build upon her a battlement of silver. If she is a door, we will enclose her with boards of cedar. Now, as she gets older, the brothers bring forth a couple of different situations. If she is a wall, in other words, if she remains chaste sexually, then she's going to, it says, we'll build upon her a battlement of silver. It means that she's going to be adorned. If she chooses to be a girl of purity, then she is going to be adorned for that. She's going to be a beautiful thing. Now, if she is a door, speaking of that she's open to sexual impurity, well, then the brothers say, we're not going to let this happen. We're going to enclose her with boards of cedar. We're going to board her up. If she decides that she's going to go chasing after some guy before the time. And so that's really a cool thing, I think, that these older brothers, and they may have been harsh on her at times, but, you know, that's siblings, but they were looking out for her. And Tirzah responded to it and how she lived her life. In verse 10, she says, I am a wall. I am a wall. She chose to be a wall and not a door. Beautiful thing. We need to teach our young girls to be walls. It says, and here we go. And my breasts like towers. Then I became in his eyes as one who found peace. And so she chose to do the right thing. And then she had this awesome and the beautiful physical relationship with Solomon because of that. It says, Solomon had a vineyard at Baal Haman. He leased the vineyard to keepers, and everyone was to bring its fruit, bring for its fruit 1,000 silver coins. Then Solomon said, my own vineyard is before me. She says to Solomon, you, O Solomon, may have 1,000, but those who tend its fruit, and those who tend its fruit, 2,000. So again, we have one of those passages where I don't know exactly what she's talking about. I don't really know this vineyard and these keepers and 1,000 coins. And your guess is as good as mine there. Verse 13, you who dwell in the gardens, the companions, listen for your voice and let me hear it. And then she says, make haste, my beloved, and be like a gazelle or a young stag on the mountains of spices. And so she calls to him once again. And so we have this ongoing relationship. Now, as we close this time, and this book ends on a good note, and again, we're left to kind of wonder exactly how where it all went south. But what we see in how the book started and now how it's ending is that when you pour your treasure into your spouse, it's cyclical. It just keeps on going around. In other words, that if there's this cycle of love and of affection and of respect and of mutual submission, then what's going to happen is the marriage relationship is going to come back to you. It's going to build. But when there's do things the wrong way, well, it's going to be a cycle of just garbage. And so maybe if you're in a cycle, a not good cycle right now, it's time to break free and to do something different. So my conclusion and my takeaway from this book would be just that, again, that physical intimacy in marriage is an excellent thing. It's a good thing. It's not something to be embarrassed about. It's not something to be, oh man, well, you know, good Christians are not like this, that type of thing. But it's the attitude of this is something that God created, and it's something that really binds a marriage together. But also to take a lesson away from it is that Solomon, again, for whatever reason, just totally went off course. And to realize that, hey, you know what, there's a choice I have to make every day. Every day, am I going to love and honor my spouse? Or am I going to kind of go off in one way or another? And so I would encourage you and I to come back to this book and to say, hey, you know what, maybe I'm missing out on complimenting my spouse. Or maybe I'm missing out on this thing or that thing. And maybe I need to not be the one to wait for my spouse to say that thing that I would like them to say to me, but I need to be the one to initiate. I need to be the one to put this on the right track. So, again, just seek the Lord and what He would have you to take away from this book. And let's pray. Lord, again, thank You for Your grace toward us. Lord, I know that there's just a lot of stuff in this book, and I don't understand it all. But I pray, Father, for what application we can take away from it, that You would make it clear to us. I pray, Lord, for that passion, that desire to know Your word, Lord, that passion, that desire to work on our marriages, and Lord, that they would grow and be honoring to You. I thank You, Father, for my wife and for how much You've blessed me through her, and I thank You for children. And Lord, I pray that as we just see Satan continually pick off marriages, that, Lord, You would help us to put the work in to keep our marriages safe and sound. And pray for Your Holy Spirit to lead us and guide us as we close in worship. In Jesus' name, amen.